Chapter 59. Brussels, Mr. Joe's attired a pair of horses for his open carriage, with which cattle, and the smart London vehicle, he made a very tolerable figure in the drives about Brussels. George purchased a horse for his private riding, and he and Captain Dobbin would often accompany the carriage in which Joe's and his sister took daily excursions of pleasure. They went out that day in the park for their accustomed diversion, and there, sure enough, George's remark with regard to the arrival of Rawdon Crawley and his wife proved to be correct. In the midst of a little troop of horsemen, consisting of some of the very greatest persons in Brussels, Rebecca was seen in the prettiest and tightest of riding habits, mounted on a beautiful little Arab, which she rode to perfection, having acquired the art at Queen's Crawley, where the Baronet, Mr. Pitt, and Rawdon himself had given her many lessons, and by the side of the gallant General Tufto. "Sure it's the Duke himself," cried Mrs. Major O'Dowd to Joe's, who began to blush violently, "and that's Lord Uxbridge on the bay. How elegant he looks! Me brother, Molloy Maloney, is as like him as two peas." Rebecca did not make for the carriage, but as soon as she perceived her old acquaintance Amelia seated in it, acknowledged her presence by a gracious nod and smile, and by kissing and shaking her fingers playfully in the direction of the vehicle. Then she resumed her conversation with General Tufto, who asked how the fat officer was in the gold-laced cap, on which Becky replied that he was an officer in the East Indian service. But Rawdon Crawley rode out of the ranks of his company, and came up, and shook hands heartily with Amelia, and said to Joe's, "Well, old boy, how are you?" and stared in Mrs. O'Dowd's face, and at the black cock's feathers until she began to think as he had made a conquest of him. George, who had been delayed behind, rode up almost immediately with Dobbin, and they touched their caps to the august personages, among whom Osborne at once perceived Mrs. Crawley. He was delighted to see Rawdon leaning over his carriage familiarly, and talking to Amelia, and met the aide-de-camp's cordial greeting with more than corresponding warmth. The nods between Rawdon and Dobbin were of the very faintest specimens of politeness. Crawley told George where they were stopping with General Tufto at the Hotel du Parc, and George made his friend promise to come speedily to Osborne's own residence. "Ori, I hadn't seen you 3 days ago," George said. "At a dinner at the restaurateur's rather a nice thing. Lord Barrisers, and the Countess, and Lady Blanche, were good enough to dine with us. Wish we'd had you." Having thus let his friend know his claims to be a man of fashion, Osborne parted from Rawdon, who followed the august squadron down an alley into which they cantered, while George and Dobbin resumed their places, one on each side of Amelia's carriage. "How well the Duke looked," Mrs. O'Dowd remarked. "The Wellesleys and Maloneys are related, but, of course, poor I would never dream of introducing myself, unless His Grace thought proper to remember our family tie." "He's a great soldier," Joe said, much more at ease now the great man was gone. "Has there ever a battle won like Salamanca? Hey, Dobbin? But where was it he learned his art?" "In India, my boy. The jungle's the school for a general, mark me that. I knew him myself too, Mrs. O'Dowd. We both of us danced the same evening with Miss Cutler, daughter of Cutler of the Artillery, and a devilish fine girl, a dum-dum." The apparition of the great personages held them all in talk during the drive, and at dinner, and until the hour came when they were all to go to the opera. It was almost like old England. The house was filled with familiar British faces, and those toilets for which the British female has long been celebrated. Mrs. O'Dowd's was not the least splendid amongst these, and as he had a curl on her forehead, and a set of Irish diamonds and cairngorms, which outshone all the decorations in the house, in her notion, her presence used to excruciate Osborne, but go she would upon all parties of pleasure on which she heard her young friends were bent. It never entered into her thought, but that they must be charmed with her company. "She's been useful to you, my dear," George said to his wife, whom he could leave alone with less scruple, when as he had this society. But what a comfort it is that Rebecca's come. He will have her for a friend, and we may get rid now of this damned Irishwoman. To this Amelia did not answer, yes or no. And how do we know what her thoughts were? The coup deal of the Brussels Opera House did not strike Mrs. O'Dowd as being so fine as the theater in Fishamble Street, Dublin, nor was French music at all equal, in her opinion, to the melodies of her native country. She favored her friends with these, and other opinions in a very loud tone of voice, and tossed about a great clattering fan she sported, with the most splendid complacency. Who is that wonderful woman with Amelia, Rawdon, love? Said a lady in an opposite box, who, almost always civil to her husband in private, was more fond than ever of him in company. Don't you see that creature with a yellow thing in her turban, and a red satin gown, and a great watch? Near the pretty little woman in white? Asked a middle-aged gentleman seated by the querist's side, with orders in his button, and several under waistcoats, and a great, choky, white stock. That pretty woman in white is Amelia, General. You are remarking all the pretty women, you naughty man. Only one, begged, in the world, said the general, delighted, and the lady gave him a tap with a large bouquet which as he had. Bet it's him, said Mrs. O'Dowd, and that's the very bouquet he bought in the marshy ox floors. And when Rebecca, having caught her friend's eye, performed the little hand-kissing operation once more, Mrs. Major Ode, taking the compliment to herself, returned the salute with a gracious smile, which sent that unfortunate Dobbin shrieking out of the box again. At the end of the act, George was out of the box in a moment, and he was even going to pay his respects to Rebecca in her loge. He met Crawley in the lobby, however, where they exchanged a few sentences upon the occurrences of the last fortnight. You found my check all right at the agent's? George said, with a knowing air. All right, my boy, Rawdon answered. Happy to give you your revenge. Governor come round? Not yet, said George, but he will, and you know I've some private fortune through my mother. Has Auntie relented? Sent me £20, damned old screw. When shall we have a meet? The general dines out on Tuesday. Can't you come Tuesday? I say, make Sedley cut off his mustache. What the devil does a civilian mean with a mustache, and those infernal frogs to his coat? Bye-bye. Try and come on Tuesday. And Rawdon was going off with two brilliant young gentlemen of fashion, who were, like himself, on the staff of a general officer. George was only half pleased to be asked to dinner on that particular day, when the general was not to dine. We'll go in and pay my respects to your wife, said he. At which Rawdon said, H.M., as you please, looking very glum, and at which the two young officers exchanged knowing glances. George parted from them, and strutted down the lobby to the general's box, the number of which he had carefully counted. Entres, said a clear little voice, and our friend found himself in Rebecca's presence, who jumped up, clapped her hands together, and held out both of them to George, so charmed was she to see him. The general, with the orders in his button, stared at the newcomer with a sulky scowl, as much as to say, who the devil are you? My dear Captain George, cried little Rebecca in an ecstasy. How good of you to come. The general and I were moping together tete-a-tete. General, this is my Captain George of whom you heard me talk. Indeed, said the general, with a very small bow, of what regiment is Captain George? George mentioned the TH. How he wished he could have said it was a crack cavalry corps. Come home lately from the West Indies, I believe. Not seen much service in the late war. Quartered here, Captain George? The general went on with killing haughtiness. Not Captain George, you stupid man. Captain Osborne, Rebecca said. The general all the while was looking savagely from one to the other. Captain Osborne, indeed. Any relation to the 50 Osbornes? We bear the same arms, George said, as indeed was the fact. Mr. Osborne, having consulted with a herald in Longacre, and picked the alarms out of the peerage when he set up his carriage 15 years before. The general made no reply to this announcement, but took up his opera glass. The double-barreled Lorgnon was not invented in those days, and pretended to examine the house, but Rebecca saw that his disengaged eye was working round in her direction, and shooting out bloodshot glances at her and George. She redoubled in cordiality. "How's dearest Amelia? But I needn't ask. How pretty she looks! And who is that nice good-natured looking creature with her a flame of yours? Oh, you wicked men! And there is Mr. Sedley eating ice, I declare. How he seems to enjoy it! General, why have we not had any ices? Shall I go and fetch you some?" said the general, bursting with wrath. "Let me go, I entreat you," George said. "No, I will go to Amelia's box. Dear, sweet girl. Give me your arm, Captain George." And so saying, and with a nod to the general, she tripped into the lobby. She gave George the queerest knowingest look when they were together, a look which might have been interpreted, "Don't you see the state of affairs, and what a fool I'm making of him?" But he did not perceive it. He was thinking of his own plans, and lost in pompous admiration of his own irresistible powers of pleasing. The curses to which the general gave a low utterance, as soon as Rebecca and her conqueror had quitted him, were so deep that I am sure no compositor would venture to print them were they written down. They came from the general's heart, and a wonderful thing it is to think that the human heart is capable of generating such produce, and can throw out, as occasion demands, such a supply of lust and fury, rage, and hatred. Amelia's gentle eyes, too, had been fixed anxiously on the pair whose conduct had so chafed the jealous general, but when Rebecca entered her box, she flew to her friend with an affectionate rapture which showed itself, in spite of the publicity of the place, for she embraced her dearest friend in the presence of the whole house, at least in full view of the general's glass, now brought to bear upon the Osborne party. Mrs. Rawdon saluted Joe's too, with the kindliest greeting. She admired Mrs. O'Dowd's large Cairngorm brooch and superb Irish diamonds, and wouldn't believe that they were not from Golconda direct. She bustled, she chattered, she turned and twisted, and smiled upon one, and smirked on another, all in full view of the jealous opera glass opposite. And when the time for the ballet came, in which there was no dancer that went through her grimaces, or performed her comedy of action better, she skipped back to her own box, leaning on Captain Dobbin's arm this time. No, she would not have George's. He must stay, and talk to his dearest, best, little Amelia. "What a humbug that woman is!" honest old Dobbin mumbled to George, when he came back from Rebecca's box, whither he had conducted her in perfect silence, and with a countenance as glum as an undertaker's. "He writhes and twists about like a snake. All the time she was here, didn't you see, George, how she was acting at the general over the way? Humbug acting! Hang it, she's the nicest little woman in England," George replied, showing his white teeth, and giving his ambrosial whiskers a twirl. "Who ain't a man of the world, Dobbin? Dammy, look at her now, she's talked over Tufto in no time. Look how he's laughing. Gad, what a shoulder as he has. Emmy, why didn't you have a bouquet? Everybody has a bouquet. Faith, then, why didn't you buy one?" Mrs. O'Dowd said, and both Amelia and William Dobbin thanked her for this timely observation. But beyond this neither of the ladies rallied. Amelia was overpowered by the flash, and the dazzle and the fashionable talk of her worldly rival. Even the O'Dowd was silent, and subdued after Becky's brilliant apparition, and scarcely said a word more about Glenmalony all the evening. "When do you intend to give up play, George, as you have promised me, any time these 100 years? Dobbin said to his friend a few days after the night at the opera. "And do you intend to give up sermonizing?" was the other's reply. "At the deuce, man, are you alarmed about? We play low. I won last night. You don't suppose Crawley cheats? With fair play, it comes to pretty much the same thing at the year's end. But I don't think he could pay if he lost, Dobbin said, and his advice met with the success which advice usually commands. Osborne and Crawley were repeatedly together now. General Tufto dined abroad almost constantly. George was always welcome in the apartments, very close indeed to those of the general, which the aide-de-camp and his wife occupied in the hotel. Amelia's manners were such, when she and George visited Crawley and his wife at these quarters, that they had very nearly come to their first quarrel. That is, George scolded his wife violently for her evident unwillingness to go, and the high and mighty manner in which she comported herself towards Mrs. Crawley, her old friend. And Amelia did not say one single word in reply, but with her husband's eye upon her, and Rebecca scanning her as she felt, was, if possible, more bashful and awkward on the second visit which she paid to Mrs. Rawdon than on her first call. Rebecca was doubly affectionate, of course, and would not take notice, in the least, of her friend's coolness. Think Emmy has become prouder since her father's name was in the since Mr. Sedley's misfortunes, Rebecca said, softening the phrase charitably for George's ear. Upon my word, I thought when we were at Brighton she was doing me the honor to be jealous of me, and now I suppose she is scandalized because Rawdon and I and the general live together. Why, my dear creature, how could we, with our means, live at all, but for a friend to share expenses? And do you suppose that Rawdon is not big enough to take care of my honor? But I'm very much obliged to Emmy, very, Mrs. Rawdon said. Pooh, jealousy, answered George, all women are jealous. And all men too. Weren't you jealous of General Tufto, and the general of you, on the night of the opera? Why, he was ready to eat me for going with you to visit that foolish little wife of yours. As if I care a pin for either of you, Crawley's wife said, with a pert toss of her head. Ill you dine here? The dragon dines with the commander-in-chief. Great news is stirring. They say the French. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.